Pray and please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Richard from Our Common Welfare.
Hey everybody, my name is Richard and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Richard.
Oh my god, there's people on Zoom too. Thanks for finding the correct password. So I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a person living with depression, anxiety disorder, and addiction to amphetamines. Thank you, Colleen and Tom, for having me here. I moved to Quakertown. I'm in Quakertown, like 5 minutes away in Spinnerstown, actually, for those of you who know this area. And I moved here back in 2005, and I didn't really go to many meetings in Quakertown on a regular basis, but I always kind of thought this first group was like their premier speaker meeting. So I made it. So my sobriety date is March 8th, 1988. I've been sober for a little more than 35 years. I looked on my app, it said it's 12,881 days of doing this one day at a time. And if you're looking at me right now, you're all thinking, wow, he has got to be the hottest old-timer you've ever seen. And for verification, I am smart, sexy, sober, and savage. The good news I want to tell you is that the effect Alcoholics Anonymous had on me was extremely positive. That today I'm living a life beyond my wildest dreams, a life I thought I ever imagined I would have, and just simply having a life. You took me at the age of 17. I was at my end. I was drinking, and I was using other drugs, specifically amphetamines. You took me at the age of 17, no question of whether I deserved a seat in these rooms. Not only did you take me, but you surrounded me immediately. The guys took me right to the diner, and that's where all this began. There was no question of whether, was I too young to be an AA? There was no question of, is my drug addiction a disqualifier from being in these rooms? And there was no question that the exact place I needed to be was right here. And you all saved my life. At the age of 17, I was in high school in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, Lenape High School. And it was kind of like, this is a senior year. This is the last time that we're all going to be together before we kind of go our separate ways. And that aspect was actually terrifying to me because there was no possibility for me to live past the age of 18. I didn't see a life for myself past the age of 18. I hated the life I had at the age of 17. How could 18 possibly be any better than 17? Alcohol was working for me for a period of time. When I started to drink alcohol, I actually believed it was the magic potion that made the actual difference in my miserable life. Alcohol made me happy. Alcohol made me forget about things I didn't like about my life. And in the way, alcohol did things for me that I wish I did for myself. People liked me. People wanted to be around me. People seemed to laugh with me. My grades improved, actually, so my parents were happy with that. Not that my parents knew I was drinking, but all these things, kind of like the things I really wanted to have happen in my so-called miserable life was happening to me. And then surely, at some point, no people just didn't want to be around me anymore. Suddenly, these friends I had were just, you're not really good to be around. I was getting into fights, and, the routine was, hey, go to the parking lot, movie theater, check out what's going on, who's having a party, let's go. And when I showed up at the parking lot, people wouldn't tell me where they're going. So, instead of going to all these gatherings with these so-called friends, I drank by myself because that was actually better than being by myself. So I began to drink by myself, and I actually found immense solace in that because nobody would fight with me. Nobody would actually tell me what a freaking a-hole I have become. And there was nobody to fight with except for myself. But the one thing I couldn't get rid of was that sense that I can't stand being in my own skin. It was disgusting to be with myself. Late night television was horrible because around that time there was a writer's strike. So even the David Letterman show, which was like, for those who were of that time period, 1988, there was reruns, you know. So drinking vodka, being high on amphetamines, drinking by myself, pretending and actually having a good time, that was kind of my existence. The grades that kind of got better went downhill. And a lot of things I used to be involved in, people did not. So I used to be part of the drug distribution system in high school. Like most high schools, they had a drug issue. So I was a part of it. And it was a way to make money because I had to find a way to, you know, generate income to fuel my addiction. And I got kicked out because I was a perfect a-hole. I have scars on my chest from all the fights I got into because people had to teach me a lesson. And because I developed keloids, which means that I developed excessive scar tissue where areas of muscle, those scars are still here. And it's always a reminder of where I came, you know, where I came from. So here I am at the age of 17. And what I knew about alcoholism was I did not believe I had a drinking problem. I thought maybe I had a drug problem. But because it wasn't like the potheads and the cokeheads that were in my school, I can't be. Because I can manage myself. I can manage my drinking. Everyone's doing it. You know, it's normal. It was normal in my family. I came from an alcoholic family. To me, our family had a lot of liver disease. And that's actually something we talked about. My uncle had liver disease. My father had liver disease. So it's like, it's normal to have liver disease, you know? So, but it wasn't caused by drinking. It must be genetic, right? And so my sense of alcoholism, I remember in health class, in a textbook, there was this picture. And it said alcoholism can look like different things. One picture was like a woman, an older woman in its ballroom, like a nightgown kind of, like a ballroom gown kind of thing, sophisticated person. And the next picture was a guy laying in the gutter in street clothes and says, you know what, that's alcoholism. I go, great, got it, not me, you know? So what happened in, how the message of alcoholics got to me was there was the drug problem in high school was pretty bad. So bad that they were starting to do some work. And because I had been involved in the drug distribution system that I was no longer a part of, I think people were concerned I was going to knock people out because I got out of the game. So I thought, okay, I need to stop using amphetamines because if they start drug testing us, I don't want to be caught. So when I withdraw from using amphetamines, what do? I compensate it by drinking even more. Because that's what got me through detoxing from amphetamines. But drinking was not a problem. It was just a way to get through. It was a part of my daily routine, or regular routine rather. I don't say daily because I could not always get alcohol. I would make that vodka bottle stretch so long because I knew I would not get enough. And there were times I wasn't sure where my next supply would come from. I was 17 years old. I had to rely upon guys who were 30 and 40 years old to give me my alcohol. And I will tell you, there were times I did things to make sure I got the alcohol at no matter cost. Because if I didn't have the money, I had skills. Think about that. But I didn't care. I didn't care. I didn't have a problem. So they're going to bring this like anti-drug speaker in. We heard rumors of a sweep coming through. And so I remember that my high school had 2,000 kids, and they put us in the big assembly, brought this anti-drug, what do you call those people, those gurus, you know, those motivational speakers, whatever. And I found myself in this assembly like, oh my God, I feel like the loneliest person right now. Because how did I get through all these years of growing up with these same kids and none of these guys are my friends? So I heard the drug talk. And then towards the end of the program, he called up all the kids that were clean and sober, who were living a life in recovery. And I see all these people I kind of hang out with go one by one. First of all, I explained why they're away for 28 days, duh. And then I kind of realized, okay, well, good for them. But around that same time, I don't know exactly what happened, but somewhere it was imprinted in my mind. There was a resource room to go to if you wanted to go for help. Now, I was detoxing from using amphetamines. I was actually trying to stop drinking because I didn't want people to know I was drinking in school. So, not, The story got verified 20 years later, but the perception I had at the time was, I was brought to this resource room, whether I went willingly or was brought there, I don't know. And this person's talked to me, and this person was also a fellow classmate. And I don't know exactly what happened, but somehow the NA meeting list made it into my pocket. The staff of the school really felt that I was in such condition I needed to go get hospitalization. And that freaked me out. What even freaked me out even more is they're going to tell my parents. And it was believed that you needed, I was 17 years old, it was believed at the time that you needed to be 18 to sign yourself in, but if you wanted to be committed, you actually had to get parental consent. Now, fact, you don't need parental consent if you're not of age to enter drug or alcohol treatment. But we didn't know that then. So bringing my parents into this was not great. They felt they needed to know. And I grew up Chinese-American. My parents immigrated to the United States and Taiwan, made a life for us here. So the way that we deal, or the way that my family dealt with alcoholism is that you don't talk about this, or addiction, you don't talk about this outside of the family. Rehab was not going to be an option for me. So all I kind of remember was being home and being told I needed to stay in my room, and I detoxed by myself. I didn't like it. I would probably tell you I experienced auditory hallucinations, but I don't recall exactly. But I can tell you this, at some point in being at home detoxing by myself, for the second time in my life, I hit my knees. And at that time, I believed there was no higher power, except for myself, by the way. But I hit my knees for the second time. The first time I hit my knees was a time where I almost accidentally killed my brother. He's fine. But that was the first time. The second time was during this agony I was experiencing. I hit my knees and I just sort of said out loud, I'll do anything, anything to feel better. The NA meeting book I found. And it kind of made sense. So I found my ways to the room on Narcotics Anonymous. And the area that I got sober in, there weren't enough NA meetings for each day of the week. So Lofton said, go to AA meetings, because there were a lot of cross-addicted addicts in those meetings. And I went. And I really believed that I had a drug addiction, because I really felt that was the core of my problem. And I did accept that alcohol was a drug, that drinking, I could no longer continue. None of you said I didn't belong here. A lot of you probably knew I was questioning myself. But because all of you knew exactly what I was going through, you let me come back and let me figure it out. Through your own example, through your own stories, and yes, when I walked through these rooms, everybody was my mother's and father's age to me. You were all old people. But again, I was 17, but I wasn't the only person that was younger there. One of the first people I saw was this friend named Maggie. She graduated a year ahead of me. But she saw me in that first meeting I went to, my first AA meeting. She saw me, and she saw me, and I came in late, because I didn't know where any churches were. There was no GPS, we had to use maps. So she saw me, I came in late, she goes, and pointed me to a seat. This meeting had like an anniversary at the beginning of the month or whatever. And after the meeting, she grabbed me and said, hi. And she said, let's go introduce you to the guys. And these men, I don't know how it happened, but I was driven to a diner, fed a burger and coffee. They gave me their numbers and told me it was going to be okay. If you have any questions, if you have a call about anything, you call me. Day or night, call me. They didn't know anything about me except I was in pieces. I felt like that. But for the first time in my life, it felt like this is exactly where I belonged. That initial sense of like, wow, this is where I belong, was probably the most immediate sense of gratification other than the detox that I felt like, okay, there is a way. There was a way. Because I was determined to kill myself before I turned the age of 18. And I think Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous was my last chance. I soon figured out alcohol is a problem, and I have alcoholism. have the same disease that all of you have. Yeah, I'm 17. My circumstance is very different. I didn't lose that job. I didn't get that divorce. I didn't crash that car. But the same feelings that most of you had expressed in all these meetings resonated with me. I didn't compare my experience to your own experience, but I tried to identify. And once I began to not think about, wow, he cheated on his wife and now they're divorced and blah, blah, blah. You're worried about child alimony payments and blah, blah. As once I began to identify the experience that you've been through, I knew I belonged. And there really wasn't much of a question. Except the occasional patronizing from some of you. Yeah, I get it. It was with good intent. I wish I'd gotten sober at your age. Heck, I wish I'd gotten sober at 14 instead of 17, you know? And again, well-intended men and women who wanted to say that you have a shot at a life. I didn't believe it. I really didn't believe because I was still in that mindset of there was not much left for me. But there was something that you showed me that I didn't expect quite at all, that amongst many of you, there was this joy about you. Smoking and joy. That was my perception. This back then, you can smoke in any meetings. Smoking and joy. How could a bunch of people in NA and AA be so freaking happy? I didn't know what to think, actually. But there was a joy about your lives, despite the horrible tragedies and situations that got you here, and the horrible situation and tragedy that was still your life. You found joy. You found freedom. You found happiness, and you found a place in this world. And then I began to want that. Because I really thought the only thing I would get out of here was a way to stop drinking. I didn't believe or expect I'd be handed a life. I didn't mess up my plans in my life so bad that I was accepted into a college before everything went bad. Going to the back of the high school, I didn't want to be at home. Put this down, so it's falling out. I didn't want to be around home because my parents were just disgusted with me and I didn't like them anyway. And I had to go to school because I wasn't going to graduate. I didn't want to go through school again. So going back to the same place of people, places, and things was really hard. But suddenly, the vice principal who I used to go to, and because when you get in trouble, you get disciplined by the vice principal, the vice principal's office became a place of refuge for me. The teachers let me, if I wasn't feeling okay, the teachers would say, you can go hang out at the vice principal's office. The man who I resented the most because he would give me a whole lot of crap about what I did was now the safest place in that entire school building for me. Thanks to that person, thanks to his secretary, and thanks to a handful of very caring teachers, I made it through. I probably should not have graduated high school on my own merit. I think they actually got me out of there because they thought that was the best thing they could do for me. I'd been accepted into Drexel University prior. By the way, that was the number one party school in Philadelphia, just so you know. So I didn't mess up my plans, did not get accepted into Drexel University. So I think when I talked with enough people, they said, you should leave, get off. You know how they say don't make any major changes in your first year? That's what's kind of a weird thing to me, because all you're doing is making major changes in your first year. But talking to the right people, they said, it's probably the right move for me. And I took that chance. The sponsor ahead of time told me a couple of things. I said, you know, when you get there, find a way to do service, because that's going to plug you right in. Because when you go to a town like Philly, there's a lot of big personalities to watch out for. And it's hard to find your place in there. Number two, you're not a newcomer. I was maybe 6 months or probably 8 months sober by the time I moved to Philly. But I was not a newcomer. So I didn't have that like, hey, I'm new to AA, give me the attention as a newcomer. I'd already had about 8 months of sobriety in my pocket. So how else am I going to get plugged into a whole group of people who didn't know how I came, where I came from? Very sadly, 2 months after I moved to Philly, my sponsor was killed in a accident. And he was killed by a drunk driver. The last message he shared with me was getting involved, and I did. And I think getting involved in service really made a difference for me because it allowed me to not only do something that I could be, feel like I'm worth something, but it plugged me into a group of guys that would also save my life. I had depression. I had anxiety disorder. It wasn't well managed. In my first 18 months, I was in the ER 3 times for near suicide attempts. And I will tell you that thank you to the people who do professional services for saving me because it was tough. And a lot of us have depression, anxiety disorder, and I'm not alone. But it was hard. But you know what, though? Something stuck with me. Keep coming back, and I did. And I came back. I was a freshman now at college, trying to find a sober life. And I remember the first week I was there, I was like, fraternity, trying to get me to pledge for that fraternity. And I remember someone told me, Richard, you actually belong to the largest fraternity in the world, Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing there that they have to offer you, but someone else wants the password to the meeting. what was I saying? Thank you. AA offered me the greatest fraternity there was. The fellowship that each and every one of you offered me was more than I could ever imagine. Those times where what I was going to do Friday and Saturday nights was answered. I hung out with you. Yeah. I fell into a group of guys that had 5, 10, 15 years of sobriety, and they let me hang out with them. And believe it or not, 35 years later, a lot of these men are still sober today and still my friends. Some of them have died. Age happens, but wow, they're amazing. They were amazing. I was living in the dormitory, and actually I got in trouble with their resident advisor. They kind of pulled me aside, and they had a meeting with me, and they said, Richard, you know, when freshmen, a lot of freshmen have a hard time adjusting when they come to a university. They don't know anybody, and we noticed that you're going out every night. You come back smelling like cigarettes every night. The phone calls you take are very secret, you know, and no one recognizes the people that are picking you up. So we think that, and I'm like, I'm going to any meetings and AA meetings, and their mouths are like. The good thing about that was I decided that I actually needed to leave the dormitory because it was a hard place to be. A lot of drinking, a lot of drug use was going on. And now that they said, like, hey, that's fine. If you need any help, let us know. And one of the rules about being a freshman at Drexel University, if you want to live on campus, you have to commit to living in the dorm for the first year. And they let me out. And I actually got my move into this guy's house, a friend of mine in AA. They called him Higher Power Jerry. That was fun. And so I got to, you know, live with him, and now I was actually living this new life now. That I was now living in a place that was completely sober, and now I was living with my unassigned sponsor. I had a sponsor, and then the Higher Power Jerry is my roommate, and they both like double team me all the time. It was crazy. And, but you know, I didn't know it, but it was actually really good for me. It was really, really good for me. I kept coming back. I did about 30% of what you suggested, maybe 25%. I did a lot of it. But you know what, though? If I didn't do it, what you said stuck with me. Because what I learned was, you were right. I was as willing as a hard-headed alcoholic. I loved doing things my way. It's what I knew. And how I learned was everything doing everything wrong. I have a hard time telling people what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery because almost everything I learned is doing things by falling on my face, picking up my butt, and moving forward and moving on. That's how I learned. So I am the worst person for advice because I can tell you how I got out of awful situations, but I can't tell you to do the right thing. Now, after all this time, I'm moving into that place where I'm doing the right thing more and more often, and I'm seeing the results that come from it. Those 10 steps to do at night, done. Very, very short. So it's like 35 years later, I hate jumping ahead to 35 years because I'm omitting everything that happened between 1988 and 2023. This life I never thought I'd have. I hit 1 year, By age 22, I was 5 years sober. I'm still looking for those marbles, by the way, to talk about. By the age of 27, I was double digit sobriety. And there were still times I was the youngest person in that meeting, but the oldest, the longest person in sobriety. By age 37, I was 20 years sober. And by age 47, I was 30 years sober. And I'm 52, almost 53, and I have 35 years of sobriety. But I don't think of my recovery in this totality of time. I still think of myself as living one day at a time. That stuck with me really, really well. I can manage to get myself through one day at a time. And I can do enough just to get through today, but also plan for a better tomorrow. Not to jump ahead, but I think one of the most exciting things I'm doing right now is retirement planning. I know, right? So yeah, I'm thinking about moving into this 55 plus community over in Coopersburg, you know. And yeah, wow. Yeah, I'm thinking about, and like, am I going to have a life where I'm older, gray, and playing pickleball all my life? I can't imagine that. As a young man, I wished somebody would just kill me because it would be easier than killing myself. I really thought, actually I fantasized about my funeral because I thought then and there, people would have seen the value if they just paid attention. I fantasized about that, you know? Well, they'd miss, you know, they'd miss me. Oh, he was so nice. He gave free drugs all the time, you know, like all those things, you know? Yeah. Lost a lot of money that way too, but it does get you friends to a point, then they start ragging on you for different things, but anyway. Over the years, again, the years begin to fly, and there's an expression that time flies, you're having fun. And I can tell you that my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has been absolutely phenomenal. It's amazing. If I met myself 35 years ago and said, you have no idea what's ahead of you and all of the amazing things that you would experience and do, no way. Absolutely no way. But I can't put it into words. I feel bad that I can't describe it because I can't fit it all into the next 20 minutes. I can't. I can tell you that all those promises that they read to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, they've come true for me over and over and over and over again to the point where I'm used to it. I'm not jaded, but this is the kind of life I now live. I can tell you that that I'm having a great time in my life. I'm actually having an effing ball. There are parts of my life I'm really doing great. And, you know, for the kid who didn't almost graduate high school, I actually teach part-time at a university as adjunct faculty for their graduate program. And they call me Professor Lou. Mm-hmm. Actually, I tell them to call me Richard because that sounds weird to me still. And believe it or not, I've gone from helping to deal drugs in my high school, and now I work at one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world doing international marketing for them. And now I've achieved my childhood dream of becoming the leader of a drug cartel. But in a way, as a young man, everything I wanted, secretly desired, and hoped for came true. I was able to love, find love, and be loved. I found immense purpose and value to my place in this world, that I had worth and value, and I participate in our community. I'm still here, guys. I haven't quite left, and I'm still giving back. I see a lot of my friends on the Zoom monitor here, and the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, when a lot of the meetings began to shut down, you know, I saw a lot of the meetings in the Philadelphia region convert to Zoom, and over in Lehigh Valley, they're just like closing one door after another. And so I started this daily online meeting called Our Common Love for Lehigh Valley. And it was an everyday meeting, 8 o'clock. And I think right away it began to fill some of the fellowship gap that people were feeling because of their isolation. And for whatever reason, people were unfamiliar with technologies and platforms like Zoom. The meeting stayed, got a lot of people coming. And when the things began to reopen, people were saying to me, you know, will this meeting continue? Because we kind of like this a lot. And it's almost 3 years later, and this meeting is still meeting every day of the week at 8 p.m. It's a Lehigh Valley-based meeting. And it gets 30 to 50 people a night. That's a big group in the Lehigh Valley. Think about it. And it's my home group. Never in my 30-some years I thought a virtual meeting would become my home group. But what made a home group for me was, before the pandemic, I was used to be a member of the Doylestown Gay Men's Discussion Group. And I kind of could come back there because a lot of those guys are my old friends. Guys who have known me for 20, 30 years, you know. And so sometimes when you get a bunch of long-termers, old-timers, whatever, we kind of get stuck in our ways. And we were not very friendly to newcomers. And I think our primary purpose became diminished, that we weren't really involved in carrying the message anymore. We are more interested in socializing. And damn it, if I had to hear about his damn sister again for the past 20 years, I'm going to hear that story again. So thank God the pandemic happened, because this introduced me to a new opportunity to help start fill a meeting need. But then all of a sudden it became a new home group. So this virtual meeting, I think, is probably the most functional AA meeting group I've ever been a part of in my life. And I've been to a lot of business meetings, y'all. But that's because I think they're really centered on carrying the message. And that's what it came primarily about. So through that, I found renewed value in what I was doing, a new way of sharing. I mean, just because of my job, I was already doing 3,000 online meetings. I had an inkling of what to do. I think like in 3 days, I learned how to be a Zoom admin, started the meeting, and all of a sudden the meeting blew up. So, hey guys out there. So that meeting continues to meet regularly. My current commitments today for service, I'm no longer an officer of that group. I do believe in the spirit of rotation. I remember shortly as my first year as chair came to an end, I said, I'm no longer going to serve as an officer. And a lot of them were like, oh, you know, our Zoom master, what we do, you know. And believe it or not, the group went on without me, just as it should. And they're going great. They're represented in general service, they're represented in the group, and they're still carrying the message. So my current service commitment now is I'm on the Bucks County Host Committee for PENCIPA. PENCIPA, as many of you know, is the Pennsylvania State Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'll tell you, as a young man in AA, young people's meetings, young people's events, and young people's conferences were really important to me because they were the only AA dance where I felt like they played my music. It was also the place where all the cool people went. I still wanted to be cool, you know? And it was also the place where I saw a lot of the other young people who looked like me. Again, 17 or 18 or 19, I was even young among the young people there. But it was a place where, like, you know what? I'm not such a freaking Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I do look around and say, yeah, I'm not that 50-year-old guy here. I'm only like 19 or 20. So young people's events, young people dances, young people conferences were of great importance to me. And I'm still serving. So if you don't know, our state conference is being held this July 14th through 16th in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. I see two committee members here. Heidi, raise your hand. She is a committee member. She spoke here 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? Something like that. And Bob over here, Bob L., he's also a committee member. So if you have any questions about the conference, come see him. For those of you in Zoom, just hit me up on Zoom. But that's my commitment. So I'm still doing service. One thing I learned about doing service now is I resented old-timers for a lot of reasons. Patronizing, big book thumping, tradition stomping, know-it-alls, and guess what? I became a big book thumping, tradition stomping, you know, GSO, know-it-all. I will insert myself into every effing decision. I will make sure my opinion is known. And I became one of those guys. But now I've done a pretty good job moving away from leading deacon to elder statesperson. And that's the role that I'm still learning to do. Because I remember when I was a young guy, and those old-timers were going, da, 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 da. That's how we did it back in whatever date. That doesn't work anymore. It didn't help me, It didn't help a whole lot of people. So I'm still learning that part. I can't believe I'm trying to embrace being an old timer now. It's kind of strange, you know? The best way I can really exemplify my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is to share with you one of the worst experiences I've had in my recovery in my life. And in doing this, I want to share with you how AA, the things I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous get me through. So one of the best things I did for myself was to come out of the closet as a gay man, being true to myself, you know. And I met a guy, and we found love. And this is back in, I was like 5 years sober, by the way. When I was 5 years sober, I had it all together. The marbles, I played with all of them really, really well. I almost want to tell you it takes 20 years to get any sense of normalcy, but each your own path. But anyway, so I thought, okay, I'm ready for a relationship. You know, I'm a man, I'm experienced, I've got 5 years of sobriety, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I met this guy, I felt madly in love with him. I was like, wow, someone who gets me, someone who just gets me. Like having that, like, you know, sense of this person absolutely gets me. And I was still in college. It took me a long time to graduate college for all sorts of reasons. But I was, you know, so I was working part-time. He worked at a video store. What's a video store to some of you? Netflix in a box, but you had to go somewhere to get the box in order to play it in your VCR. a device that plays videos.
Wow.
So we fell madly in love with each other, and I thought, wow, this is great. This is absolutely the relationship I've always wanted. I used to go pick him up at the end of his night at his video store, and we go back to my place to hang out. And I went there, and they said, he's in the hospital, and that's all they could tell me, you know. He didn't show up, and they just heard that he took himself to the hospital. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I tried to, you know, find out anything, and because I'm not considered family, I couldn't get any information about him. So I didn't know for about 3 days. About 3 days later, he called me and said, I'm here. Okay. And, you know, come and bring Arby's. Because that's what he liked. So I came, brought Arby's food, and just a matter of a minute, he told me that he had pneumonia. And he had a specific type of pneumonia called pneumocystis carini. And there was a specific type of pneumonia that was common for people with AIDS to have. So not only did I find out that he almost died of pneumonia, but he also had AIDS, caused by a virus called HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. My world turned over right there. The love of my life. What did that mean for me? What did it mean for him? And the situation was dire. There's something called T cells, and they're a part of your immune system. And your immune system is a system in your body that fights off infections and cancers. And when your immune system is depleted, you become highly susceptible to infections and cancers. And so in a regular healthy person, your T cell count would be somewhere between 800 to 1200. His T cell count was 7. Treatment for HIV was very new at that time. Very new. I understood that our time was going to be limited. We spent the next year trying to carry on with our lives. He went back to work. I went back to school and worked part-time still. With the money we could scrape up, we went to do things that we wanted and could afford to do. We flew to Atlanta. He got to see the Coca-Cola exhibit. We went to D.C. We went to a gay rights march in D.C. We got to do that. He saw me graduate college. And then 2 years later, he died. It was a fast death, thankfully. Being a gay man, the AIDS crisis was in its worst days. The meetings were devastated by the AIDS crisis. I was not the only person that was affected by this disease, but as a lot of us were. What came after his death was actually the worst part. The grief was more agony than I have ever experienced in my life. Towards the end of his life, his parents reappeared. And they said some really awful things like, I gave him this disease. Or how could I let this happen to him? And then when he was dead, they took his body. They didn't invite me to his memorial service. They pretty much cut me out of his life. Until this day, I still don't even know where his final resting place is. And I was furious at that. Because for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, till death to us part, I was not his legal partner. His parents had every right to him and his stuff. Actually, they left the stuff to me. I had that at least. It was awful. The agony of all that. Seething anger at his parents. And the worst grief that I thought I ever would endure in my life was awful. But I can tell you, through that, and even in the days where his health began to deplete, that I had the source of strength that I never knew was ever in me. I didn't know exactly how it happened or where it came from, but I was there. In the days where, in the hospital, the food service workers would leave the tray outside of the door because they were afraid to come into the room, I stood up against the discrimination. I became his medical advocate, and I stood up for him in the days that he couldn't. I found him that, and again, we had these families, our biological families, and our families of choice. And his family of choice arrived, and I was not alone in this. And we all took care of him. We were his family. He was my family. Even the seething anger that I had towards his parents and the utter grief I was experiencing from the loss, you all instilled in me that no matter what would happen, I was going to be okay. And I knew, as heartbroken as I was going to be okay. I couldn't find any heart to hate God. I could not muster anger towards God because I just had this inherent belief that everything I was going through, I was going to be okay. You all gave me that. And he also taught me through one day at a time, no matter how bad it is, how difficult it is, you will find a way to put one foot in front of the other and keep going. I learned early on that if you hang on to seething anger, I'm going to use or drink again. And I needed to find a way to get to deal with it, and I did. And the tools you taught me gave me the ways to deal with it. One example of the way I dealt with it was, yeah, the parents cut me out of his life, and I don't know, not even invited to the memorial service. They lived in Florida. And but if I ever needed to find him, and his name was Scott, I didn't need to go to a tombstone or a marker. All I had to do was go in my heart and find him, and there he was. Oh my God, I could feel my heart beating. He chose me to be his family. Me. My heart's beating so much right now. My God, he's right there. And I found the way to acceptance because of everything you taught me. It took a lot of meetings. It took a lot of you just hearing me stomp my feet in meeting rooms, banging on tables. None of you ever said, you can't do that here. Don't come back, you know, don't come back here again. You let me be. You let me come back. You let me rage. If there's a circle up, if I didn't join it, you're okay with that. You put up a lot with me. One day at a time, I can be okay with it. And I found my place back in this world again. Strangely, I finished, because I have a college degree and I had been doing some volunteer work in HIV, long story short, I became one of the youngest AIDS program directors in the city of Philadelphia. And then I decided to go get a master's degree because they said, credentials after your name, you can do much better than what I can do now. So I got a graduate degree. And then year 12, I was in a better place. You know, I really believed I could have moved on from where I was and I was going to be okay. I mean, many of you showed that to me. Some of you just lost your spouses in some of the most awful circumstances. Some of you lost children and you still persevered under the worst circumstances. If you can do it, so can I. Thank you for giving me that hope. And for the people who have been through that, wow. Thank you for knowing what it was like, knowing how it felt for me. The time you gave me was invaluable. So, strangely, by year 12, I got recruited to this place called Valley Forge, or this hospital in Norristown. And they said, we're looking for a new AIDS program director here. So I listened to you. I didn't know much about it. It was on the internet, but not really well, didn't have a good website or anything. And next thing you know, I'm interviewing to become the AIDS program director of a drug and alcohol treatment center. And they want me to run their program for alcoholics and addicts with HIV or AIDS. I'm thinking, oh my God. I will say that when you're working in professional treatment is not 12-step work because I'm receiving compensation for that. And I work with patients whether I like them or not. They can spit in my face and yell at me, but I still have to work with them. But I can't ignore the coincidence that I was recruited to this place to run their AIDS program, and they had no idea I was a person in recovery. I didn't tell them until afterwards, after I got the job, and said, by the way, I'm 11 or 12 years sober or whatever. Good. This will make training so much easier. Because our last director got burnt out. Somehow, I found this new life fighting HIV and AIDS in this world. Worked there for about 10 years. I burnt out. You know, for many of you who have been professionals in recovery who have been doing drug and alcohol treatment for a long, very long time, I burned out. I don't know how many of you did it, but I burned out and I made a career change. And slowly, the short version has been now, I'm now one of the leaders in my drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, HIV drug portfolio. And I work with 80 countries around the world making sure that our products are available. And then I promote them and talk about, you know, what they do. And, God damn. Wow. Yeah. That's what my life became. God also gave me a second chance. And I found the room in my heart to want to fall in love again. And in 2001, I met this really great guy. And long story short, we've been together now for 22 years. And I had so many second chances in recovery for so many different things. And like I just said, we're now planning for what our older life is going to be like. You know, living in an older 55 community, people there told me you'd be among the youngest people there. And I'm like, oh, I look really good for my age, you know. I really do. And I can't believe I'm at this point in my life where I'm planning I'm planning for the end of my life, but I'm planning to live a well life going forward because I know what matters to me most. I don't know if I will continue to stay clean and sober, but if I ever were to fall, I know exactly where to go. Although many of you will probably kick my ass for that, but I can make the best plans going forward for myself to ensure I have the best opportunity to do right by myself, do right by those I love, and do right by those who have come to love me. I can't imagine I'm really in this place in my life. I sponsor four men, two were out of state. Technology, this is crazy. My first long-distance sponsee was a young man I met at one of the young people's conferences. And he was 17, and he was actually in a boarding school in New York. He lived with his family in Long Island, but he was in boarding school in upper state New York because the high school, blah, 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 blah. And so he didn't have a sponsor because in the area that he lived in, he wasn't able to go to meetings all the time because someone on staff, he had to rely upon staff. And this is a part of New York where it's very distant and there's a few meetings. And he didn't want to have a sponsor in one area and have another sponsor in Long Island where his parents were. So he taught me how to Skype and how to communicate with him. We did Skype hugs and all that kind of thing. And he told me it was possible to sponsor anybody from almost anywhere. And to this day, I know I'm not a sponsor, but I have two men that I sponsor, one in Arizona, one in Maine, two that are here, and I'm still doing it. It still astonishes me why guys want me to sponsor them, because I offer the worst advice. Because I really can only tell you what I did when I F up. I really can't tell you how to do things right, because that wasn't my experience. I now know enough to not pretend I know everything, even though I think I do. Ask my husband that. He thinks I know everything. But I know when to say I don't know. And maybe I can point you into a direction that where you may be able to get the right support or help or information. My husband now tells me I have a maximum. I cannot take on any more sponsees. Otherwise, I won't have a husband anymore. But my husband is not in his fellowship, but he's grown to love and respect the things that we do in his fellowship. He's still very unhappy when I take time away from him, but he sees the man that I've become, and he knows why I do it, because he knows it's good for me. He knows it's good for the gentleman and some woman that I help. Let me tell you one more quick story. When I got sober, I was sober, but I wasn't really looking healthy. And some guy said, you probably should go see a doctor. And the short version is that I got diagnosed with alcoholic hepatitis, form of liver disease that many chronic drinkers get. And my uncle had. Actually, my uncle died from this disease, too. And I was told that I had a 40% chance of dying from liver cirrhosis or liver cancer because of my alcoholic hepatitis. My liver had become so inflamed. And the only thing that they had to offer as treatment was to not drink. I was already convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to save my life. By year 12, my liver tests showed as normal. I owe that to all of you, and I can tell you, till this day, my liver tests are still normal. I'm still at risk, but I'm normal. But I had this great joy during my annual visit with my gastroenterologist. They now find particular joy in assigning me one of the new fellows who meets me, look at my case, and going, how did you do this? And I can tell them it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have an opportunity to carry the message that it worked for me. I sometimes don't like going because you know how you go now, you're like 10, 15 minutes, you're in and out. I'm there for an hour. And they're like, come over here, you have to meet this guy. He has alcoholic hepatitis, his liver enzymes are normal. Look at him, he's hot, you know, and they want me to tell how I did it. And I have this great opportunity to share our message. Thank you to all of you for saving this life. And I really hope that I made a good use of it. Thank you to the Feet First group for doing what you do. I respect your speaker meeting greatly. I can't believe I'm finally a speaker at Feet First. And thank you to everyone here, everyone who came through these doors before, and all those who will come through the future. You did it. You improved my life. And I appreciate that very much. Thank you very much.